This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Master the Card. Say goodbye to credit card debt forever. And the author is Joe Peretta. And Joe joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this special segment brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
This is very timely and applicable across the board, isn't it? We all struggle from one extreme to the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Credit card debt is something that so many people are dealing with, as you said, from one extent to the other, and whatever the economy happens to be, so many of us can relate to it.
You say this about your book: it provides a concrete plan for people wishing to conquer their credit card debt. You also present ways in which quality of life improves while debt is being paid down and eventually eliminated. And you call this book a book with personality. I like that.
Yeah, it really is, because the way that I present it is almost conversational, in the respect that I want the reader to feel like he or she and I are speaking about the situation. You know, so many books are either preachy or like a textbook, and I want this book to really come across as though it's conversational and motivational at the same time. And that's such an important distinction for people who feel overwhelmed by credit card debt. They need to feel motivated, encouraged as they start the process of digging themselves out of debt.
And you approach this from experience.
Yes. Yeah, I had, I would say somewhere around $12,000 of credit card debt at its worst, at its highest point. And finally, I said, enough is enough. Something has to be done about this, because I felt every dollar that I was making was going towards payments on these cards, and they were only the minimum payments. So I was hardly keeping my head above water. So once I challenged myself to change my habits, I started to move in the right direction.
Now, did you stop cold turkey, as they say?
No, actually, the first year that I made a concerted effort to start paying off the debt, I did not go cold turkey, but I drastically reduced the number of times that I used the card. The second year that I was starting to pay off, I did go cold turkey, and then on occasion thereafter, I was able to for a certain number of years. It's very hard to change habits cold turkey overnight. So I felt the best thing for me to do was to wean myself off of the cards. Then eventually I realized, you know, I could go day to day without using these credit cards. They weren't a necessity, as I had led myself to believe for so many years. So not at first, but eventually I did go cold turkey.
Most people, I would think, from my own experience, you know, you get a credit card, you get your new credit card, you get one sent to you, and you go, well, this is great to have, and it just, you know, makes sense to have a credit card, and you can't imagine abusing it when you first get it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny, I kind of excuse me, equates the getting the new credit card to almost that new car smell when you buy your brand new car. It's got this sort of luxury feel to it, and this luster. And then once you start to use it, and it sort of loses that newness, and it starts to wear a bit, and ultimately you get into the habit of using this card, and it gets you into more trouble than anything else. For me, when I first started getting into credit card debt when I was in my early to mid-20s, I convinced myself that it was a rite of passage. I was an adult now, so, you know, I was supposed to have a credit card debt. So all these little rationalizations got me into some trouble until I realized that I had to make some changes.
And it's an ego booster, I think, for people when you see that credit card line. You know, you can charge up to the, boy, you're important.
Exactly, yes, yeah. And we don't realize at that time that we're no different from anybody else, because so many millions of other people are getting this exact same card with this exact same credit limit. So at first, yeah, it definitely is an ego boost, and then eventually it's a smack of reality.
Yeah, it can become a chain around the neck, can it?
Yeah, absolutely, an albatross, yep.
Well, what do you tell people when they say, hey, there's no way I can get out of debt?
Well, I tell them that was actually my first reaction 2 years ago. And it's important for people to vent a bit, to let out their frustrations, even if they're negative and they feel like there's no way I can do this. It's important for them to get that off their chest, because until they do that, you really cannot speak rationally to that person. So I let them have those few minutes of venting, and then I say, okay, now what we really need to do is get a firm handle on this situation. And that means seeing exactly how much we owe, what the interest rates are, how many cards we have, because so many people who are in credit card debt have absolutely no idea how much they owe, or even how many cards they have, which seems almost illogical. But when you get into such a habit with these credit cards and you keep applying for more and they keep sending them to you, the situation escalates. So they say they can't do it, but I first and foremost say to them, I think we can do it. We just need to get some things down on paper. We have to face this reality head on before we can get a game plan together.
You teach that credit card debt is temporary. It's not a life sentence.
Yeah. And, you know, that's an important thing for people to know, because up to this point, they've been using the card so often and they've been racking up so much debt that once they realize how much they have, they sometimes think that the debt is going to outlive them. And I tell them that, no, that's not the case, because now that we see that there's a problem and we're going to take the steps necessary to change things, the debt itself is going to be temporary, because you're not going to be using the cards as much, if not at all. So that temporary nature takes hold once we start to shift away from the credit card use and then ultimately put together this repayment plan to start getting out of debt.
And it's so easy to look in the mirror and just see this bad person because you have a lot of debt.
Absolutely, yeah. So many people, myself included back in those days, would do something like that and beat ourselves up and, really sort of chastise ourselves. And no good will come of that, especially if that's a recurring theme. As I said at first, if you want to vent or beat yourself up a little bit for a few minutes, okay. But, got to get that out of your system in order to move back in the right direction.
Yeah, you're not an outcast of society.
No, and whether fortunately or unfortunately, as I said before, so many people are in this situation. So, misery loves company, so if people can take a little solace in that. But the key thing to remember is if you genuinely want to change, you can change.
Well, you must have had, been working many jobs and had high-paying jobs to get yourself out of debt so fast, right?
Well, actually, it took me several years to get out of debt. One of the things I tell people is they need to be patient with themselves. It probably took them a while to get into debt, and it will likely take you a while to get out of debt. I think it took me a good 5 to 6 years before I finally was able to get myself completely out of credit card debt. I did work 2 or 3 jobs, but not making a lot of money on any of them. So as I mentioned before, a lot of what I made was going directly over to those credit card companies, especially when I first started the process. So there was a lot of hard work just to keep my head above water. But eventually, once I started to see those balances dwindle, I became motivated to work even harder and to pay off that debt that much faster. So you don't have to necessarily make a lot of money to pay off the credit card debts, but you do need to change your spending habits, and that's the most important thing, I would say, in this whole process.
And even if you don't have a lot, just paying something, is that important just to get started?
Yeah, I think it is important to pay something. I always tell people, however, if you just pay the minimum, it's going to take you a very long time to get out of debt, especially if you keep using the card. So reducing the number of times you use the card, ultimately stopping your credit card use, and then little by little, if you start at only the minimum, okay, but discipline yourself to, in due time, pay a little bit more and a little bit more, because they have the game situated so that if you pay just the minimum, it's going to take you like 20 years to get out of a $2,000 debt. So get started. That's very important, but ultimately step things up. And you're going to not only see the balances drop, but you're going to gain confidence in yourself. And that's a key quality in paying off the credit card debt.
Why is it important to pay off the card with the smallest balance first?
Well, my feeling is, you know, money and spending especially is as much psychological as it is material. Off the card with the smallest balance first, you're going to gain a sense of accomplishment, a sense of victory. One of the things that happens when we're in debt, and as we mentioned before, we beat ourselves up and we develop this victim mentality. So if you start off by paying off that smallest balance first, you're going to gain that sense of accomplishment, that feeling, hey, I can do this. And then you start to change that victim mentality to a victor mentality. You start to feel more like a winner than a loser. So I think if you do that to get the ball rolling, that's going to help things to snowball. You're going to gain more confidence, and you're going to want to start to pay off the next smallest card as fast as possible.
So the climb to debt freedom is empowering and even can enhance other areas of life as well.
Yeah, and you know, I really get into that in the second part of the book because anytime you start to feel confident about yourself, you start to gain a sense of victory and purpose in your life. It sort of transcends that one individual issue. And I learned from my experience with getting out of credit card debt that as I paid off my debt, I started to have a more positive outlook on life. As I said, so much of this is psychological. You start to feel so good about yourself, you want to say, hey, what else can I do in life? Yeah, so much of my attention was on this credit card debt that now that I'm making strides in getting out of it, hey, I just feel really good, and I want to see if I can improve other areas of life also, whether it be career or family or things dealing with spirituality, whatever the case may be. It really sort of exudes our entire personality and persona. So getting out of debt has such a positive ramifications and almost like a snowball effect that really brings our whole life together.
And in chapter 6, which is titled Give, that's the, I guess, the second mile of life, isn't it? Living in the second mile.
Yeah, you know, so much of life is, so much of the good part of life, let's put it that way, is giving of ourselves. And so many people think of, when they hear that word give, the first thing they think about is money. And the knee-jerk reaction to that, especially for people who are in debt, is, I have nothing to give. I have so much debt. How can you talk to me about giving? But, you know, giving is more than just the dollars and cents. We have time that we can give. We have our talents and our abilities that we can give. So I tell people, you know, if you feel that you do not have any money to give while you're paying off your debt, okay, but yeah, how about an hour a week? Do you have some time to give to the neighbor down the street, the elderly person who needs her lawn mowed, or the senior citizen down the block who needs to go grocery shopping once a week? Can you drive that person to the store? And once you start to thinking about other people and their needs, again, you're not only going to be doing something good for those people, but you're going to start to feel good about yourself. So the giving mentality is so important because it lifts up our spirits. And once we see that we can do good for other people, it makes us think about ourselves a little bit differently. And it encourages us to start to pay off our debt a little bit faster, because we say to ourselves, hey, you know, I run these errands for people, or I help people in my areas of expertise. Now I'd like to expand that a bit. Now that I've got a couple extra bucks in my wallet every month because I'm paying off these cards, maybe I'd like to give to that organization or that church or that foundation, whatever the case may be. And it's really such an uplifting, positive feeling that I encourage people, you have to give something. Everybody's got something to give.
Also, as with any problem or addiction, people just may fall off the wagon.
Yeah. And, you know, that happened to me a couple of times, and my first reaction to that was to try to, you know, beat myself up a little bit. But, you know, we all make mistakes. We all do things that we look back and we say, oh, yeah, I shouldn't have done that. But we're human beings, and we make these mistakes. And with any, as with any habit, it's likely that, especially in the early part of the recovery process, we will, quote-unquote, fall off the wagon, or we will charge something that we realize later, I really didn't need that, or, you know, I could have spent the cash on that instead of the credit cards. But, okay, you did that. You realize now that that's something that maybe you shouldn't have done, but now you look ahead and you say, next time I know better. Next time I won't do that. So you have to just sort of get right back on the horse and gallop forward towards debt freedom.
And the end is really there. You can really get rid of all your credit card debt. You're proof of it.
Yeah, I'm proof of it. And fortunately, there are thousands of people out there who are proof of it also, some who had more debt than I did. But the key difference was they said to themselves, something's got to change. They started to think about what they were spending. They also started to take a look at all of their credit card bills, and they wrote down what they owed. They wrote down their interest rates. They negotiated with these credit card companies, and that's very important to do. You need to lower those interest rates. We have more authority than the companies want us to believe. So we really have to be proactive. And once we put these things on paper, they take on a life of their own, and they give us some clarity. Because once we have these things on paper, we can say, okay, this is the card that I have the lowest balance on. This is the second lowest, so on and so forth. So you start to negotiate. You start to keep clear notes. You start to have a clear file system. You see the balances go down, and that's when these positive strides can be made. Yes, I'm proof of it, and so many other people are proof of it also.
The title of the book, Master the Card. Say goodbye to credit card debt forever. And the author is Joe Peretta. Joe, tell us how to get your book.
Sure. Right now it's available online. You can go to my website, joeperetta.com. That's JOEPARETTA.com. You can also get it through BalboaPress.com, who is my publisher. Check out Borders.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon. So a whole bunch of different websites carry the book.
Joe, thanks for being with us and on Indie Book Publishing. And this segment is brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready for the Not-So-Soccer Mom Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central on TogiNet with Jill Hickey. You name it, from politics to pop culture to Jill's search for the perfect bronzer and chicken salad. The Not-So-Soccer Mom will weigh in on it all. The sentence, "I have no opinion about that," is one that Jill has never uttered. In the early 90s, Jill finally decided to put her thoughts, opinions, mom advice, love of pop culture, hummus, and Starbucks, working out, cosmetic shopping, and politics into an actual website, and thus NotSoSoccerMom.com was born. Shortly after her fourth child, a boy, Jerome, now she's really got tons of topics to share with you. This is Laugh Out Loud Funny, and we're not kidding. What's a loud Nebraska girl who lived in Little Rock for many years and now is up in the Northeast doing? Chronicling her opinions on everything. The wheels aren't off yet, but it's close. It's the Not-So-Soccer Mom with Jill Hickey, Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central, on TogiNet.com. Innovation and insight. Problems and solutions. Capitalizing on your ideas and efforts. That's all a part of Changing the World One Invention at a Time with Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. Rick will be sharing stories of innovation, invention, inspiration, and overcoming obstacles with guests who have been there, done that, and are doing that. Rick will be asking the right questions, helping you identify the real problems and showing you how to act on your ideas by increasing consumer confidence and, more importantly, increasing your confidence to act on your ideas. For even more information, go to ThinkTech, that's T-E-K, globally.com. Then join us as Rick and his guests teach us how to develop new ideas and create new products, new businesses, new jobs. And together, let's get our economy growing again. It's Changing the World One Invention at a Time with author and inventor Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The End, The Book, Part 1. And the author is Jerry L. Robb. And Jerry joins us on Indie Book Publishing, this special interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Jerry.
Hey, how are you?
Well, you're going to take us on quite a journey to the end of time, the end of this world, which a lot of people seem to be curious about. Of course, Nostradamus, the Mayans, the Hopi Indians, as you point out, say the end will be December 21st, 2012. But there's another story about the end that you say predates Nostradamus and the Indians by several thousand years. It doesn't mention 2012. Of course, this comes from the Bible, Revelations, even the Quran, right?
Even the Quran.
Even the Quran. Maybe they know something they're going to do that most people don't know, but I'm sure you're going to get into that. You say the end, the book is a thriller, a love story. We've got Jeffrey Ross, the main character, who is an atheist, and you've got Melissa, his wife. We've got a lot of different characters, but the one thing that the Bible states, as you point out, that the end will be like the days of Noah. So we're kind of like that today, aren't we?
Well, we are like that today. It's and people don't seem to know. As I've told some of my friends, a lot of people seem to be dancing with the stars and watching Entertainment Tonight while all this stuff is unfolding in the world. And I hope to enlighten some people about that.
Why are you so driven to do this? This is a very ambitious project. This is part one of a series of 7 books.
Well, I've always, since I was a little kid, Steve, I was always intrigued with the book of Revelation. What happened in 1952, the polio epidemic hit High Point, North Carolina, where I live, so my parents shipped me down to Georgia to live with my aunt for a while. And my cousin, who was the same age, when we got what we could read at night, we would sit on the bed and read the book of Revelation to ourselves and, you know, scare ourselves to death, and then we couldn't go to sleep, but we just knew John was talking about atomic bombs, because they were pretty new back in the 50s, and we just knew that's what he was talking about. Then a few years ago, I started kind of putting this book together in my head. I read the entire Left Behind series. I couldn't wait to get to the store and get the new one. And then about a year ago, my oldest daughter told me if I didn't hurry up and write the end, it was going to happen while I was still thinking about it. So she made me a web page and designed the cover of my book, and we decided to write it and sell it by the chapter as I was writing it, which I thought was a pretty crazy idea, but it turned out to be a great one. We sold quite a few books before it was even published. And the people that bought, once they bought the book, when the book came out, we sent them an autographed copy just out of appreciation that they actually had trust in me and didn't even know me. Now, my motivation came from all my years as an unbeliever. When I got out of college, I was a science major. Not many science majors come out believers. And I had my opinions, and then one day I watched a movie, 1979-80, by Hal Lindsey, The Late Great Planet Earth. Went out the next day, bought a Bible, figured I had a lot of opinions about something I hadn't ever read. I'd read lots of zoology books, but I never read any God books. So I bought a Bible and read it cover to cover and have believed ever since.
Now, there are a lot of books out there, movies that have been produced about the end of the world, and most don't seem to take into account, as you point out, that God does not need man to destroy civilization.
You're right. Absolutely right. He doesn't. And the end was predicted in the first book, Genesis, and that was long before terrorism and biological warfare and nuclear warfare. And, you know, we talk about our nuclear bombs and how powerful they are, but Mother Nature is much more powerful. We see it in hurricanes, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. Look at Japan, what just happened. So God really doesn't, he wrote the plan a long time ago, and he doesn't really need us to do it, though we're going to play a large part in it. At least that's my belief.
And your book takes into account, we're witnessing them right now, these asteroids that are passing near the planet.
Yeah, we had one pass 2 days ago. Well, Monday, passed within 7,000 miles of the planet.
I did see that. I saw that on the news, yes.
Well, and less than a year ago, there was one that passed within 3,400 miles. A lot of people don't know these things are out there, but there is a science about near-Earth objects that's run by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, and they watch for these things all the time. That's how they discovered this one that came by Monday. And though this one was about the size of a bus, it could have caused a lot of, you know, it could wipe out a small little town.
Well, exactly. And, of course, man, with all the hatred on this earth today, and, of course, the news is filled today about the terrorists, jihadists. I mean, this all is building, coming to a climax. I think anyone with any common sense, whether they're believers or not, can see there's something bad going on here.
Well, there is something bad going on, and a lot of people say, well, there's always been earthquakes, and there's always been wars, and there's always been volcanic eruptions, but there's never been those dilemmas that are going on like today. I keep up with this. Every time you read the newspaper, like right now in Los Alamos and Arizona, it's not that they've got fires, it's that they've got the worst fires in recorded history.
Right.
It's not that we have floods, we have the worst in recorded history. The tornadoes that came through and hit Tuscaloosa and Joplin, Missouri, those were the worst in history, the worst tornado outbreak in history. So when you hear all of these things, the worst in history, the worst in history, you got to think that something is going on.
And of course, not many people understand the Islamic Messiah, the Mahdi.
Well, they do not. I know many Christians and Jews, and I can't name one of them that's ever read the Quran. I'm sure they're out there, but I don't know any. And there's an author named Joel Rosenberg that wrote a book called The 12th Imam, talking about the same thing. The Iranians, well, the Iranians are Shiites. The Shiites and the Sunnis have two different beliefs about this, but they both believe that their Messiah is coming. They call him the 12th Imam, or Al-Mahdi. And the only way that he's going to come is the world has to be at war. Well, Iran has just produced a movie which they're going to translate from Farsi to Arabic and distribute throughout the Muslim world, that talks about this 12th Imam. A lot of people think he's already here. It's my opinion that there probably is a 12th Imam, but I think he's going to be the Antichrist, not a Messiah.
Well, let's talk about the characters. We have Jeffrey Ross. Now, tell us about this leading character.
Well, Jeffrey Ross, he lives in Duluth, Georgia, which is where I live. I've kind of got everything around Atlanta. And Jeff is he's a really good guy. He's very generous to other people, especially his friends, successful businessman, and kind of a flashy type guy. Only he's an atheist. And always, well, not always, but most of his life, he has been. Been married to the girl of his dreams, Melissa, for almost 25 years. But then Melissa's gone. Another tragedy of the divorce age. Jeff thinks she left because he wouldn't go to church. But as the book explains, there were a lot of reasons. Jeff's kind of a victim of a physically and emotionally abusive childhood, but he's never quite figured all that out. He's kind of flashy, but he's a good man, at least in most ways. And
He considers himself even spiritual.
Yeah, he considers himself spiritual, but not religious. I see that a lot.
Right.
I don't know what that means exactly, but
right. He's
upset with his mother, or his mother's dead now, but he was always upset with her because she referred to him as a godophobe, but he has no fear of God.
And
now,
then,
Abe the bartender is a very interesting character. He's a Messianic Jew. He's a bartender by choice. He was born in Israel, and his father was killed in a Hezbollah attack, so his mother sent him to New York when he was 12. And he's lived in the United States since. Now, he went to synagogue, but one day he decided that he would read the New Testament because he never had, and he became a believer in Jesus as the Messiah at that time. He's a very interesting character. You want me to tell you about a couple more?
Please, how about Samara?
Samara Russell. Samara is a Pakistani Jew, which there aren't many of, and she lives in the Buckhead area of Atlanta with her Christian husband, who was a U.S. senator named Jack Russell. Not the dog. And Jack spends a lot of time in Israel working with Israel's intelligence agency, Mossad. Samara is the director of research for communicable disease at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. At the threat of a beheading of her 8-year-old son, Samara provides the Spanish flu virus to a terrorist organization. Of course, she was distraught about this, but she did it anyway. I think most mothers would. And that in turn unleashed one of the worst plagues known to man. A lot of people don't know about the Spanish flu, but killed many, many people. And it's a story about her, her trials and tribulations from doing this. And it releases a worldwide plague because this virus is released through the air conditioning systems of the Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport.
Well, and unfortunately, we could imagine that happening today. That's what's so scary about all this.
Well, it is scary because that would be so easy. I'm in my real business, I deal with air conditioning and a lot of other stuff, and it would be just such an easy thing because our security is so lax that someone could just get a virus or anything into the air system of a building or a mall, and no telling who all will be infected.
And, of course, we hear a lot about small briefcase nuclear devices.
Well,
dirty bombs, I guess they're called, or maybe
they're briefcase nukes. And of course, North Korea has specialized. There was just a news article that came out a couple of weeks ago about this, but they specialize in the miniaturization of these weapons. And between them and the old Soviet Union, there's about 200 of these briefcase nukes around. Now, they're not really the size of a briefcase. They would probably go in a sample case. They're a little bigger than a briefcase. But they're 2 kilotons, which is about, I don't know, maybe a fifth the power that destroyed Hiroshima. And in this book, many of them have come into this country through the porous Mexican border. And now a really bad guy named Vinny, a few other names, he's actually from Saudi Arabia, and his name is Abood Risa. But everybody knows him as Vinny. He's been over here for many years in the U.S., for about 20 years, blending in. And he's kind of the head honcho to make all these terrorism attacks go off that are going off in the book in the Atlanta area. He's the coordinator. Very brilliant man.
Of course, we are very aware of the amount of submarines that are around the world and also, of course, have ballistic nuclear missiles on them. But you have a little twist on that.
Well, I do. I've got a hijack of a nuclear submarine in the Indian Ocean. It's one of Russia's most advanced submarines. And they managed to get a Chechenian crew, a total Muslim crew almost. The ones that aren't Muslims, they just kill them and shoot them out through the torpedo tube so it looks like the ship sunk. But it really didn't. And this hijacked sub is headed towards the Panama Canal, which is going to nuke. It also nukes Diego Garcia, at least it attempts to, which is an island in the Indian Ocean where our B-1B and B-2 bomber fleets are. This submarine provides the launch on the St. Mary's, Georgia nuclear submarine base, and that's kind of when the book is ending, but it's really just the beginning because all the world is really going to be at war once this all happens.
And then there's the HIV virus transmission via mosquito is discovered in Africa, and of course, as we've mentioned, there is a large comet hurtling directly toward Earth, and it's a big one.
It is a big one. It's about 100 miles in diameter, and it's fairly recently discovered. It's a very difficult discover because it's made out of graphite, at least the surface, which reflects radar. So it was discovered kind of at the last moment. It's going to hit in less than a year, and it is big. The 100 miles in diameter, the one that supposedly, the asteroid that supposedly got rid of the dinosaurs was only 1 mile in diameter, 6 miles in diameter, and it caused devastation of the entire world. So if this thing hits, it's going to be awful. And the book goes into detail of how we try to prevent that from happening. And when the book ends, it hasn't happened yet, but it almost has, so I can't really tell you what
right,
happens with
exactly.
this.
Exactly. Well, we've got about a minute left, Jerry. Many people look at Muslims, and in fact, I know Muslims, you know Muslims, they're very peaceful, but the tenets of Islam are anything but peaceful, so this really plays a major theme in your book.
Well, it does. Like I said in the very beginning of this interview, that most Christians and Jews that I know have never read the Quran, but you're right. My personal physician is a Muslim lady, and she's just as nice as can be. I've got neighbors that are Muslims that are just as nice as can be. But when you read the Quran, the book is not as nice as can be. It's a rewrite of the Bible. You can tell it when as soon as you see Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac and Jacob instead of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, you know immediately that
right.
If the Quran is true, the Bible is not, and vice versa. I'll put my money on the Bible.
Well, Jerry, my goodness, again, congratulations. This is part one, everyone, a series of seven books. The End, the Book, part one, and the author is Jerry L. Robb. Jerry, tell us how to get your book.
Well, you can get it through Westbow Press. You can get it through any bookstore. They'll have to order it because I'm self-published, so they don't stock it, but they can order it. You can get it through our webpage. If you buy it through the webpage, you get it autographed. And can I give you the name of our webpage?
Please, please.
Okay, it's www.theendthebook.com. That webpage also has an interview that Westbow Press did with me on their homepage. And you can also see that interview on the westbowpress.com. webpage.
Well, thanks for being with us on Indie Book Publishing, a special interview brought to everyone by Westbow Press. Jerry, thanks so much.
Steve, thank you for calling.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com.
Dakota McKeith and he's number one.
Now you might think Juan's youth was sad,
right?
Cause he had a death, dear mommy and dad,
right?
But that ain't the case,
nope.
It wasn't his fate,
nope.
The Juan's never struggled to communicate,
ha.
Y'all wave your hands, look who's on, yeah. It's Dakota McKeith. Number one.
It's That Keith Wine Show on TogiNet.com, Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central. Every week, That Keith Wine Show will have guests that share their experiences, expertise, opinions, and personal lives with us to hopefully help us better understand others. The topics and guests will come from the American Sign Language community. For more on Keith Wine and the show, go to his website, KeithWine.com. Listen with an open mind and willingness to learn and help with the cultural bridge.
Number one, Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Dakota man's on. Number one, Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Dakota man's on.
Don't miss That Keith Wine Show. Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Through the Eyes of Another, A Medium's Guide to Creating Heaven on Earth by Encountering Your Life Review Now. And the author is Karen Noe. And Karen joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this segment brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Karen.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, good to have you with us. I'm just going to read a couple of things about you.
Okay.
First of all, you're the author of two books. Your first book was The Rainbow Follows the Storm, How to Obtain Inner Peace by Connecting with Angels and Deceased Loved Ones. You're a psychic medium and healer with thousands of clients, and you have a spiritual healing center called Angel Quest in Ramsey, New Jersey, and also you're the host of Angel Quest Radio on WRCR Radio in Nanuet, is that what it is?
Nanuet, New York, that's correct.
Nanuet, New York. Where is Nanuet?
It's close to Bergen County, New Jersey.
Oh, okay, right down near the border.
Uh-huh.
All right, well, you say that we don't have to die to go through our life review. We can go through it now before it's too late. So we're going to talk about that, as well as writing different types of letters to help you see the bigger picture of how you are affecting those in your path. That's an interesting topic in and of itself. So, Karen, tell us how all this happened. When did you discover that you were a psychic?
Okay, well, it goes back to when I was a child. The minor things started happening to me. I would have dreams that would come true before they happened. One example was I dreamt my cousin died, and she wasn't even sick. And a few months later, she was diagnosed with cancer, and she died a year later. And my father used to take me to the racetrack when I was little, and I picked the winning horses.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. But about 15 years ago is really when I started receiving messages from those who crossed over and the angels. I was going through a rough time in my life, and I was sitting at the edge of my bed. I guess I yelled at God. I said, am I going to be okay? And with that, I saw a light coming towards me from the other side of the room. And my first response was, if you're not of God, please leave. But the more I said that, the more it came towards me, actually came inside of me, and the most incredible peace came inside of me. Right after that, it's a long story, but right after that, I started hearing and feeling the angels and people who've crossed over. And I didn't want to share this with anyone. I didn't want anybody to think I was not in my right mind or things like that. But when I did give in and started sharing the information, it meant so much to the people I was telling, you know, the messages to. It were the names of the people who crossed over and very specific messages. So I decided, okay, maybe I should do this. And I started off with one person that I had a reading for in the back of a hair salon. And here I am now at the Angel Quest Center. I'm booked a couple of years ahead of time. I don't advertise or anything. It's all for mediumship to connect with their loved ones.
Now there
are, so that's basically it, yeah.
Now, there are a lot of books by mediums about the afterlife. There's books about near-death experiences. What makes your book different?
Well, I combine the two. I'm surprised I hadn't seen anyone write about this topic before. Many times when a person comes through in a reading, someone who's crossed over, they often say they should have or could have done certain things, and they feel it was too late. For example, they felt they should have spent more time with the person who's in my office, or they shouldn't have lied to them, or something like that. I often hear from the person who's the living loved one who is sitting in my office that they should have or could have done certain things, and now they feel it's too late as well. I hear this too often, so I said, why don't we do something about it? Why don't I use the knowledge, the wisdom that I have obtained from the afterlife to help us to create more peaceful lives here and now, and we don't have to wait till we cross over. And how do we do that? Well, what happens is after we cross over, we're able to see the bigger picture on how we have affected each person through each person's eyes, as if it's our own feelings. We're able to feel it, whereas before we might have been self-centered, not realized how we affected the other person, and here it is now, we see it. So I'm trying to get people to see things through other people's eyes right here and right now. Try to see where the other person is coming from.
Tell us about this life review that you say we don't have to go through after we die. We can go through it right now.
Yes. So as I said before, after we cross over, we're able to see if we did good, if we did bad. It's not that God judges us and says we go to a certain place. It's not like that at all. What happens is we actually judge ourselves, and we see where we've done good or we haven't done so good. So we're in this place of all-knowing, almost like seeing through God's eyes. And we could see how we affected that little boy, say, when we hurt him when we were little or something like that. We're able to see that through the life review after we cross over.
What are these different types of letters that we can write? What are the guidelines on how to write them?
Okay. Well, so I wanted to teach people how to see through the other person's eyes. And a good way of doing that, well, I conducted an experiment on how to, you know, try to see the other person's point of view. I had a group of people that participated in the experiment as well, and we sat down and wrote different types of letters. There's a gratitude letter where we tell the person how much We ask how they made a difference in our lives. What are some of the things they love or admire? You admire about them. In other words, tell the person how much they mean to you now, and not wait till you cross over. Then there's a letter to yourself. And what you have to do is try to see the bigger picture on how you are affecting yourself. In other words, too often we put ourselves last. So what we want to do with this type of letter, we want to write as if we're speaking to someone else, and you discuss why you love yourself, talk about your proudest accomplishments, and, you know, maybe see what you could do differently to make yourself feel better. You know, and if you're unhappy with certain things that you've done, you state why you forgive yourself. You know, you'd be very kind, just as if you're writing to someone else. Then that's a very tough letter to write, and if we have time, I'd like to explain that in more detail.
Okay.
There's other types of letters. There's a forgiveness letter. There's the writing a letter of forgiveness when you're trying to forgive someone else, or if you want someone else to forgive you. And you want to make sure it's a very positive letter. You want to include everything that you love or appreciate about the person. Make it don't attack, because the recipient will feel responsible only if he feels safe and not judged. And that's a very important thing. And then you decide whether or not you want to mail it. It's totally up to you. And I'd love to get in more detail again if we have time. And then finally, there's the letters to our deceased loved ones. And even though I said before, you know, we may think it's too late to write a letter to our loved ones who crossed over. And it really is not, because if our intention is to heal relationships or to tell them how much we love them, and our intention is all it takes for them to be in the room with us, and they're able to feel or, you know, see what we have written. A good story is one time I was holding a class, and there was a gentleman in the classroom. It was a class on how to connect with angels and deceased loved ones. And during the middle of the class, a woman came through. She said her name was Laurie. And in the classroom was a gentleman who I never saw before at that time. Now I do know him. His name was Brian. And Laurie said her name. She said, "Tell Brian, my name is Laurie, and to tell Ryan, I hope you could follow this, that I have seen what she has been writing to me." Now, Ryan was his daughter, and she was writing to her mom, Laurie, about day-to-day incidences, what was happening to her. And she was keeping that connection open with her mom. And the greatest part was that the mom had indeed been seeing what Ryan had been writing. So that was the greatest part. And he went home and told his daughter, and she was so excited. So those are the four types of letters.
Well, it sounds like quite a process, great process of therapy.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
For everyone, it sounds like. Both sides, right?
It really is. And I'd love to give another example.
My own mom has
crossed over in January of this year. Now, what she comes to me all the time, which is a wonderful thing. Thank God I'm able to connect with her. But when I was going through this process of writing the letters, I participated in this experiment as well. And my mom, we had a very close relationship, and I wrote a letter of gratitude to her before she died when I was writing these letters on how much I loved and appreciated her and all the things that I remembered she did for me, you know. And that was 2 years ago. So in January, as I said, she passed away, but 2 days before she passed away, she was in a coma, and she was in her house in a hospital bed in hospice, and I went in her bedroom. And the letter that I had written to her was on the desk. I just started crying. I knew, you know, it made a difference to her. Now, she was very unresponsive at that time, but I took the letter and I pulled a chair up to her bed, and I read the letter to her, you know, exactly as I had written it. And although she was unresponsive before, I could see in her eyes and her facial expressions that she heard what I was saying to her. And it was so comforting to know that those were my last words to her. You know, and I had it all written down, and I didn't plan it that way. I certainly didn't, but there were really no words left unspoken, you know, to my mom. And it was just so helpful for me when she crossed over. Now, again, we had a wonderful relationship beforehand, so there was nothing to forgive or anything like that. But it truly made a difference in my feelings. You know, I knew there was nothing that I should have said to her before she left. So that really helped me.
What do you say to people who just won't believe that you can do this, that there's really this medium that, you know, psychics are, for the most part, just, you know, fantasy.
Oh, well, I don't force my ideas on anyone, for sure, you know, certainly. And everyone has their own opinion, and I embrace that. It's people come to me, and when they come to me, I give them, you know, the readings and everything. And when they do come through, the people give me information that I would never know. Such as, I'll give you an example of one of my favorite readings. When I started doing this, I said, well, how do I know I'm really doing this? To make a long story short, they usually say their name, stuff that the only things that only the person in my office would know. But this one particular time, as I just started out, he said his name. I can't remember. I think it was Robert or something. And he showed me a kangaroo with boxing gloves. I didn't want to tell the woman that I see a kangaroo with boxing gloves because it was so bizarre. But finally, I mean, he was very persistent, so I said, he's showing me a kangaroo. There's a man named Robert in the room, and he's showing me a kangaroo with boxing gloves. And the woman screamed, and she said, my friend Robert just died recently, and he boxed kangaroos in Australia. So what happens is I would never have known that. And things like that come up in the readings. That's right. Why people come. And I certainly, if somebody doesn't believe in it, I'm not here to try to make them believe, you know. Not at all. I'm just trying to help them to obtain peace and to connect with their loved ones if they come to me.
Well, we have enough time left, a minute or so, for you to say a little bit more about this personal letter that you mentioned earlier, the importance of it.
Yes. Too often, especially myself, and I'm sure there are a lot of listeners out there that are going through the same thing, we put everyone else ahead of ourselves. And when I was writing this book, the most important intention was to see through the eyes of others how we are affecting them. And, you know, then I said, well, what about how we're affecting ourselves? So I sat down to write myself a letter. And as I said before, you have to write as if you're speaking to someone else. And I said, Dear Karen. And then, you know, I wrote everything that I was proud of myself, what I had accomplished. And if I did make mistakes, I was very kind, and I said, okay, but you did the best you could. You didn't do it on purpose, you know? And when I wrote that, it just, oh, my gosh, I never thought of it that way before. You know, if I saw good qualities in other people, I saw it, but I never saw it in myself, and it really was life-changing for me. And now, because of the letter, I'm just treating myself with more respect and dignity, and, you know, I'm just as important as everyone else. And that is my wish for everyone as well, to see that they, too, are important.
We have enough time for some closing thoughts, Karen.
Okay. The most important thing I could tell our listeners is that after we leave this body, first of all, we're energy, and we're spiritual beings having a human experience. And after the body goes, the energy continues. It does not end, and it's very scientific. As science says, energy doesn't begin and it doesn't end. This is not, okay, after the body goes, the soul of who we are continues. This is not something I think or believe. This is something I know without a doubt. And my wish is for everyone to know this too.
The title of the book, Through the Eyes of Another, A Medium's Guide to Creating Heaven on Earth, by Encountering Your Life Review Now. And the author is Karen Noe. Karen, tell us how to get your book.
Yes, you could get it on my website. You could www.karennoe, that's karennoe.com, or you could go to amazon.com or barnesandnoble.com, balboapress.com as well.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for being on Indie Book Publishing. This segment brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thanks again, Karen.
Thank you. Angel blessing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.